So I want to welcome everybody who was able to make it out this evening and took time to come and worship God. Tonight's subject is one that there's a bit of controversy that surrounds the particular stories that I'm going to be talking about. But I think as Christians who trust the Word of God, we can trust what God has said in His Word. Now, no, this is not anything that's going to break our religion. It's not going to do anything like that. I'm not teaching on that. Don't worry. It's fine. But what I am teaching on tonight has some controversy, specifically within the scientific realm, as to whether or not it even happened. And that subject is giants. Now, there is a spiritual application that I'd like to make in a moment, but we are going to start with the two stories of the two most famous giants that we know of, Goliath and the Canaanites. Goliath is a pretty simple giant that even science will say can exist. But the Canaanites are a different case, and that's what I want to talk about today. The reason why I want to talk about it is to give us some perspective. Quite frankly, we today don't have giants. The tallest person that we know of in secular history is Robert Wadlow. The man was 8 foot 11, but he was not strong enough to be that of Goliath. He could not have wielded a sword. He could not have taken anyone down. But Goliath was 6 cubits, and yet somehow he was able to still wield this power. The Canaanites, on the other hand, were just a tiny bit bigger. Before I get to that, let's turn our Bibles over to 1 Samuel 17 and refresh our memories as to what happened with David and the giant Goliath. So in 1 Samuel chapter 17, beginning in verse 1, the chapter begins by saying, "Now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle, and they were gathered at Succah, which belongs to Judah. And they encamped between Succah and Azekah in Ephesus. I'm not even going to try to pronounce that. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered and camped in the valley of Elah, and drew up in battle array to encounter the Philistines. The Philistines stood on the mountain on one side, while Israel stood on the mountain on the other side, with the valley between them. Then a champion came out from the armies of the Philistines, named Goliath, from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span, roughly 9 feet. He had a bronze helmet on his head, and he was clothed with a scale armor, which weighed 5,000 shekels of bronze. He also had bronze greaves on his legs and a bronze javelin slung between his shoulders. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam. The head of his spear weighed 600 shekels of iron. His shield carrier also walked before him. He stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel and said to them, 'Why do you come out to draw up in battle array? Am I not the Philistine and your servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will become your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall become our servants and serve us.'" Again, the Philistine said, "I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Now David was the son of the Ephrathite of Bethlehem in Judah, whose name was Jesse, and he had 8 sons. And Jesse was old in the days of Saul, advanced in years among men. The 3 older sons of Jesse had gone after Saul to the battle. And the names of his 3 sons who went to the battle were Eliab, the firstborn, and the second to him, Abinadab, and the third, Shammah. David was the youngest. Now the 3 oldest followed Saul, but David went back and forth from Saul to tend his father's flock at Bethlehem. The Philistine came forward morning and evening for 40 days and took his stand. Then Jesse said to David, "Take now for your brothers an ephah of this roasted grain and these 10 loaves, and run to the camp to your brothers. Bring also these 10 cuts of cheese to the commander of their thousand. And look into the welfare of your brothers and bring back news of them. For Saul and they all, the men of Israel, are in the valley of Elah, fighting the Philistines." So David arose early in the morning and left the flock with the keeper and took supplies, and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he was to the circle of the camp while the army was going out in battle array. Israel and the Philistines drew up in battle, army against army. Then David left his baggage in the care of the baggage keeper and ran to the battle line. As he was talking with them, behold, the champion, the Philistine from Gath named Goliath, was coming up from the army of the Philistines. And he spoke these same words, and David heard them. When all the men of Israel saw the man, they fled from him and were greatly afraid. The men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man who is coming up? Surely he is coming up to defy Israel. And it will be the king. It will be that the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel." Then David spoke to the men who were standing by him, saying, "What will be done for the man who kills the Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is the uncircumcised Philistine that he should taunt the armies of the living God?" The people answered him in accordance with his word, saying, "Thus it will be done for the man who kills him." Now Eliab, his oldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men, and Eliab's anger burned against David. And he said, "Why have you come down? With whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your insolence and the wickedness of your heart, for you have come down in order to see battle." But David said, "What have I done now? What is not just a question? Was it not just a question?" He turned away from him to another and said the same thing, and the people answered the same thing before him. When the words which David spoke were heard, they told them to Saul, and he sent for him. David said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail on account of him, for your servant will go and fight this Philistine." Then Saul said to David, "You are not able to go against the Philistine to fight, for you are but a youth, and he has been a warrior from his youth." But David said to Saul, "Your servant was tending his father's sheep, when a lion or a bear came and took a lamb from the flock. I went out after him and attacked him and rescued it from his mouth. And when he rose up against me, I seized him by his beard and struck him and killed him. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be one like them, since he has taunted the armies of the living God." And David said, "The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." And Saul said to David, "Go, may the Lord be with you." So Saul clothed David with his garments and put a bronze helmet on his head and clothed him with armor. David girded his sword over his armor and tried to walk, for he had not tested them. So David said to Saul, "I cannot go with these, for I have not tested them." And David took off. He took his stick in his hand and chose for himself five smooth stones from the brook and put them in the shepherd's bag, which he had, even in his pouch, with his sling in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. And the Philistine came up and approached David, with the shield bearer in front of him. When the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth, and ruddy, with a handsome appearance. The Philistine said to David, "Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. The Philistine also said to David, "Come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the sky and the beasts of the field." Then David said to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword and a spear and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have taunted. This day the Lord will deliver you up into my hands, and I will strike you down and remove your head from you. And I will give the dead bodies of the army to the Philistines. This day to the birds of the sky and the wild beasts of the earth, and all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. And that all this assembly may know that the Lord does not deliver by sword or by spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands." Then it happened when the Philistine rose and came and drew near to meet David, that David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistines. And David put his hand into his bag and took from it a stone, and slung it, and struck the Philistine in his forehead. And the stone sank into his forehead so that he fell on his face. Thus David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone, and he struck the Philistine and killed him, but there was no sword in David's hand. I don't think we need to read any further of that. And honestly, considering how long it took to read that, we're just going to briefly skim over Numbers 13 and 14 in a minute. But just kind of a reflection on what has been talked about so far. Saul and his armies, the armies of God, are being attacked. And a particularly large giant of 6 cubits, or about 9 feet, decides that he's going to challenge not only the Israelites, but also their God. And out comes this tiny little guy. We're guessing probably 5'4", 5'6", based off of the culture. Not very tall. This 9-foot Philistine, tiny little dude. You think people will be laughing on the sidelines? You think people will think that he's just a little crazy? Probably. Most definitely, actually. But David had confidence in God. And with this confidence, he took 5 stones and only used a single one to kill the giant Goliath. Now, quickly heading over to Numbers 13. We have the story of the 12 spies. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Send out for yourself men, so that they may spy out the land of Canaan, which I am going to give to the sons of Israel. You shall send a man from each of their father's tribe." And so they go to pick out 12 spies. In verse 16, these are the names of the men whom Moses sent to spy out the land. But Moses called Hoshea, the son of Nun, Joshua. When Moses sent them to spy out the land of Canaan, he said to them, "Go up there into the Negev, then go up into the hill of the country. See what the land is like, and whether the people who live in it are strong or weak, or whether they are few or many. How is the land in which they live? Is it good or bad? And how are the cities in which they live? Are they like open camps or with fortifications? How is the land? Is it fat or lean? Are there trees in it or not? Make an effort then to get some of the fruit of the land." Now the time was the time for the first rice grapes. So they went up and spied out the land from the wilderness of Zin, as far as Rehob, at Lebo Hamath. And when they had gone up into the Negev, they came to Hebron, where Ahiman, not even going to try to pronounce that either, the descendants of Anak were, where Hebron was built 7 years before Zoan in Egypt. Then they came to the valley of Eshcol, and from there cut down a branch with a single cluster of grapes, and they carried it on a pole between 2 men, with some of the pomegranates and the figs. That place was called the Valley of Eshcol, because of the cluster which the sons of Israel cut down there. Now take note of something, and this is something that we're going to get into in just a minute. Why would a cluster of grapes need to be carried by 2 men? Not a good reason, unless they are big. The fact is, what we are about to find out is that the Canaanites were not just big people like Goliath, but were very big people. People that would make anybody, even the armies of the United States of America, a little bit scared. When they returned from the spying out of the land at the end of the 40 days, this is verse 25, they proceeded to come to Moses and Aaron and all the congregation of the sons of Israel in the wilderness at Paran, at Kadesh, and they brought back word to them in the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. Thus they told him and said, "We went into the land where you sent us, and it certainly does flow with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. Nevertheless, the people who live in the land are strong, and the cities are fortified, and very large, and moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there." We're going to keep note on that verse, and we'll come back to it in a minute. Amalek is living in the land of the Negev, and the Hittites, and the Jebusites, and the Amorites are all living in the hill country, and the Canaanites are living by the sea and by the side of the Jordan. Then Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, "We should by all means go up and take possession of it, for we will surely overcome it." But the men who had gone up with him said, "We are not able to go up against it. The people are far too strong." They gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, "This land through which we have gone is in spying it out is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people who we saw in it are men of great size. There also we saw the Nephilim, the sons of Anak. The sons of Anak are part of the Nephilim. And we became like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight." Now, to summarize the last part of it, as we understand, the congregation lifted up their voices, they cried, the people wept all night, they grumbled against Moses and Aaron, and we end up finding out that they get banished for 40 years. Yeah, not very good. The first story is a example of trust. It's an example of faith in God. David, without anyone's help, decided that he would fight Goliath and knew that God would be on his side, for this Philistine decided that he was going to curse God. The Israelites were up against a very ungodly nation, which God told them, "You shall possess this land, I will give it to you, have faith in me." But they decided they're not going to listen. Even though they had more men than David was one, they still decided they weren't going to listen. Now, it's been a while. We've skipped over all of this, and we've come to this little bit of perspective. It's funny. You see, I believe this is Looney Tunes or something along those lines. Not a very frightening giant. I mean, yeah, it's a little kid, he is. And then you have a more realistic giant. Each artist has portrayed their perspective of what a giant is. Each artist has an idea in their mind of what giants are. According to the Bible, according to Amos 2 and verse 9, the giants of this particular passage, the sons of Anak, were quite a bit larger than Goliath. In Amos 2:9 it said, "Yet I destroyed the Amorite before them, whose height was like the height of the cedars, and he was strong as the oaks, yet I destroyed his fruit from above and his roots from beneath." There's one other passage where this analogy of trees comes in, and that's actually in Job 40:15, where it talks about the behemoth. And this is one of the main arguments that we actually make to atheists, that indeed there is a God and that the Bible is true, because if anyone reads the description of the behemoth, we read of pillars being his feet, he eats the herbs of the field, and has a tail like the cedars, which the only possible animal that could match that particular description was a dinosaur, which 4,000 years ago didn't exist. This same description of a tail like a cedar's is used to describe the height of the men. And I did a little bit of research, so it's not like this is completely out of the blue. But the men of this particular time would have ranged quite a bit in height. This would have been us, right here. Tiny little people. This actually is average height of an Israelite, about 5'8", 5'6". Here's us, average male height of 5'10". Here's Goliath. Here is probably more of an average-sized giant, about 18-odd feet. Here is the tallest of their number. The tallest report of bones that I can find was 36 feet. Believe it or not, it's not really important. The story remains the same. These were large people. How large? Large enough to scare an army off. An average of their number would have carried a sword that was 80 pounds. An average of their number would have weighed 4,000 pounds. If the reports are true about the largest of their number, it would have been swords that would have weighed 600 pounds and people that would have weighed 35,000 pounds. Now, whether or not you want to believe this is up to you. I'm just showing you what the Bible says. It talks about the height of the cedars. Talks about the strength of the oaks. Would not the ability to wield a sword that is 80 pounds constitute the size of a cedar? It would. So these were scary people. These were really scary people. These were people that would scare them to death. The idea that with a single swipe of his sword he'd take out an army is a scary thought. So they had a lot of reason to be thought of, to be scared of. But they forgot one thing. And that is the point of this lesson. And I'm going to get to that in a second. They forgot that God is mighty. That God is all-powerful. And that God is greater than anything that this life can throw at them, even these giants. As you saw in the sneak peek, we have a physical equivalent. There are a lot of giants which exist in our world. A lot of giants that, with a single swoop of their sword, they could take out this congregation. It's simple. I mean, we have 30-ish members. That's easy. 30 people just go missing. That's easy work. Liberalism. We use that as a simple term. I put it in quotes because it's kind of a controversial term. The idea of liberalism is something that's very popular nowadays, but for us to say, as the Bible says, we're like Davids, and they're like Goliaths. For them to talk about atheism, they're like Goliaths, and we're like Davids. All of these thoughts, LGBTQ community gaining a lot of steam for a very small community in comparison to the majority, they have a lot of power. And they're getting their power from the masses. Thousands, millions of people who agree with them, who say it's all right. And yet here we are, just a tiny percentage of the population. We have reason to be scared. We have reason to feel like we're up against these gigantic giants. I mean, we're just like these tiny, tiny little people. And here are these giants that we're facing up against every day, just like the Israelites. But we have a secret. We have God. God is mighty. Jeremiah 32:17. Ah, Lord God, behold, you have made the heavens and the earth by your great power, and outstretched your arm. There is nothing too hard for you. Behold, I am the Lord, the God of all flesh. Is there anything too hard for me? Job 26:7-14. Job is in the middle of a conversation. I can't remember which particular of his friends he's in a conversation with, but he's making an account. But I believe it's his friend who's actually making the counter-argument. That's talking about the might of God and how great he is. And he just goes on to list all of these wonderful, beautiful things that God is capable of doing. Such as building the firmament, storing the rains and clouds. It's amazing. Just the things you see all around you, the ability of things to work. Ken talks about it all the time, and it's a beautiful thing just to look at the tiny little pieces of existence and to think that every single one of them is being controlled by God when he wants to. How much greater is this God compared to a few puny giants? It's all about perspective. In Joshua 4:19-24, we see the parting of the Red Sea. We all know the story. We've just gone through the 10 plagues. The Israelites are fleeing Egypt, and they come to this nice big Red Sea. And what happens? With a single action on the part of Moses and all the power of God, the waves divide. This is a big sea. This is an actual sea. It's a very large body of water. And suddenly, the waves just part. That's a great God. He's mighty. He's powerful. He's greater than anything these giants can supply. According to Psalms 147:4-5, this is God. He counts the number of the stars. He calls them all by name. Great is our Lord, and mighty in power. His understanding is infinite. A great and mighty God who has created an infinite universe, or at least as far as we know. This reminds me of a passage talking about that the beauty, the things that God has done are not just for our sakes, but for the sake of the angels, the principalities and powers in the heavenly places to show his might and power. For years, we didn't have access to seeing just some of the things that exist out in space, but could you imagine being an angel and sitting back and watching the power of God as he creates the universe, as he installs entire solar systems, entire galaxies, and you get to watch? You think that's a mighty God who's able to defeat your enemies, who's able to provide you with the things you need in this life? Or is he a God who's going to be pushed around? Romans 1:20, for since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Now comes our part. So we've seen all of this, we've seen the Israelites, we've seen David. What happens when big corporate, or I don't know, you could say Donald Trump, or whoever you want to, that you are afraid of, comes into place and decides that he's going to take away one of your freedoms? Fear not. Matthew 10:28, Luke 12:4-7. These are parallel passages, and they read basically the same. And I say to you, my friends, do not be afraid of those who kill the body, and after that no more that they can do. But I will show you whom you should fear. Fear him who, after he has killed, has the power to cast out into hell. Yes, I say to you, fear him. Are not five sparrows sold for 2 copper coins? And not one of them is forgotten before God. But the very hairs of your head are all numbered. Do not fear, therefore, for you are more value than many sparrows. Hebrews 13:5-6. We see a similar theme. Let your conduct be without covetousness. Be content with such things as you have. He himself has said, I will never leave you, nor forsake you. So we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me? If you read about the things that happened in the first century to the Christians who would have read these passages, it was a scary thing. Some of the things that they did, it's not worth talking about. Really, it's gruesome. It's awful. That could happen to us. But guess what? Do not fear. Do not fear. This is the most important aspect of being a Christian nowadays, is we're heading into a time where this is going to be a very relevant passage. Right now, we don't have to deal with this. We're pretty peaceful. Yeah, you have a little controversy at work, but everybody has that. Doesn't matter who you are. Imagine if they sentenced you to death. A little different. One more passage. Revelation 2:10. Do not fear any of those things which you are about to suffer. Indeed, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison, that you may be tested, and you will have tribulation 10 days. Be faithful until death, and I will give you the crown of life. When we see things like we see in the world today, they're giants to us. There are a lot of people backing up these new ideas, and people are not as tolerant as they used to be. We've preached for a long time that you're supposed to think about your fellow man and his feelings and things like that, and the Bible teaches a certain degree of peace. Try to live as peaceably as possible with your fellow man and your brother. But what happens when the other side decides that they're no longer going to be peaceable? And what happens when they're 90% of the population? We have a giant on our hands. We have a 600-pound sword coming at us. It's scary. But what does Revelation say? It says, do not fear. The last theme that I'd like to discuss is trust. Because fear is the opposite of trust. If you trust God, you're not going to fear. Faith comes in 3 basic parts. Faith, belief, and trust. Those are the 3 ways that faith is translated in the English language. This particular aspect deals with us putting confidence in and literally putting our trust in. It's kind of hard to define, but it's pretty simple when you think about it. The story of Abraham is a good example. 3-4 times, actually, his faith was tested. He was told to leave the country. Pretty scary. He was told he would have a covenant. Not so scary, more like, will it ever actually happen? 3rd, you will have a son. And 4th, I want you to kill your son. All 4 of these were difficult. Yet through each and every single one of them, he put his trust, his faith, in God. He didn't fear. He could have feared when it was time to sacrifice Isaac, but did he? No. Proverbs 3:5, trust in the Lord with all your heart. Do not lean on your own understanding. Hebrews 11:6, faith, without faith it is impossible to please him, for he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. When you have a giant coming at you, are you going to trust in God? Are you going to put aside your fear? That's the question. Because if you don't, it is impossible to please him. Mark 11:22-24. So Jesus answered and said to them, have faith in God. For assuredly I say to you, whoever says to this mountain, be removed and be cast into the sea, and does not doubt in his heart, but believes that those things which he says will be done, he will have whatever he says. Therefore I say to you, whatever things you ask when you pray, believe that you receive them, and you will have them. Trust in God. Do you trust God when you pray? Do you trust God when you pray about your enemies? Do you trust God when you pray about your giants? That's a question. It's an excellent question. Do you or do you not? This lesson has ultimately been designed not to cause controversy, but to give us some perspective, specifically on our trust in God and our ability to withstand the giants of this age. There are many giants. There are many people who have decided that they're no longer going to tolerate what we believe. And every day, as you see more things happening, it becomes more apparent that your freedom may be taken from you. And this is a giant. This is not small. This is not insignificant. This is just like David and Goliath. This is just like the Israelites. And if you're not prepared, the day will come when your faith is tested, when your trust is tested, and you will fear, and you will cower, and you will become just like the Canaanites. You'll be lost. But if you're victorious, and you decide that you will trust and put your faith in God, you will not fear. You'll become like David. So the question I have for you tonight, is there anything that perhaps we can help you with? Have you not started on your journey with God? Or perhaps you have started, but you've stopped trusting Him. You've started fearing the things in this life. If there's anything that we can possibly do for you this evening, please make it known as we stand and sing the song of encouragement.